On January 15th, 2009, the world was captivated when Captain Chelsea Sullenberger and First Officer Jeff Skiles successfully executed an emergency landing of an Airbus A320 airliner in the Hudson River in New York City. The leadership and skills from all of the flight's personnel saved everyone on board. To introduce our special guests for this evening, please join me in welcoming EIA President and Chairman Tom Poberesny.
Thank you, Steve. This has been a special week, special convention. It's exceeded all expectations in terms of the turnout, the participation, and aviation's passion is alive and well in Oshkosh. We've met many wonderful people throughout the week. You're about to meet two people that have truly made a difference for us as pilots and the aviation community. I'm very pleased tonight that we have a gentleman who's an EIA regular. He's been coming here since the mid-1980s. He helped create Good Morning America. He's done over 12,000 interviews. He knows how to engage, share, and inform an audience in a very special way. He's nationally known. He's passionate about aviation. He supports EIA. Welcome your host for tonight's program, David Hartman.
Hi. Evening, all. You all know the story. Last January 15th, U.S. Airways Flight 1549, a 10-year-old Airbus 320, took off from LGA LaGuardia in New York, bound for Charlotte. Well, a minute 37 seconds into the flight, on climbout, somewhere around 2,700 to 2,900 feet, the plane smashed into a large flock of Canada geese. 3 minutes and 32 seconds later, at 3:31 p.m., Flight 1549 was in the Hudson River. Within 3.5 minutes, all 150 passengers and 5 crew members were safely off the airplane, which had logged 5 minutes and 8 seconds in that flight. Over the last 20 years, bird strikes have destroyed 210 aircraft and killed 229 people. Flight 1549, of course, is not among those statistics. The 3 female flight attendants that day had combined experience between them professionally as flight attendants of 92 years. The first officer that day was actually a U.S. Airways captain, flying right seat because of airline layoffs. Jeffrey Skiles earned his pilot's license as a teenager and has logged about 20,000 hours as a pilot. The captain, Chesley Sully Sullenberger, earned his pilot's license at the age of 17. He graduated from the Air Force Academy. He flew F-4s for a number of years. Over 40 years of flying, he has also logged about 20,000 hours as a pilot. Welcome, please, Sully Sullenberger and Jeff Skiles. Jeff, start us off. When did you first come to EIA?
Well, my first recollection of coming to EIA was when I was at the Rockford Air Show, which was at least 1969. So that was 40 years ago with with my my family. They bought tickets and or whatever, and took me down there. Bought me a ride in the Ford Tri-Motor too.
How much did that have to do with your getting it?
Well, you know, the fact that both my parents were pilots, I was always exposed to it, and, you know, I just never wanted to do anything else. I remember that Flying magazine coming every month, you know, in the mail, and I'd have it read cover to cover by, you know, the evening that it came in.
Sully, when was your first trip to EAA?
Yesterday. Day before, actually, Wednesday.
Sully, with all your flying experience and the aviator that you are, arriving here and seeing this full-blown thing that goes on here every year, what's your impression of all it?
Well, it felt like I've come home. It feels good. It's, you know, the way I describe my profession is, it's something I've been passionate about my whole life and something I've felt very fortunate to have been able to do my whole life. And coming here just reminds me that unlike most of the people I meet, unlike most of my neighbors who don't have this passion, who don't share this love of aviation, there are still so many others out here who do. And it's kind of fun to be around that enthusiasm because it's infectious and it's contagious and it's something that's fun to share.
So, Jeff, how was the Mustang ride this morning?
That was cool. It was just so beautiful out there, and, you know, 7 a.m., and, you know, with the light and the lake and five Mustangs in formation, and they were doing, like, a photo shoot from a B-25, and then after that, they broke and they went in line and just started doing, you know, rolls and swooping down and up. It could not have been more perfect.
So let's get to the U.S. Airways flight. Talk us through it, if you would. That day, January 15th, how many flights did you have that day, Sully?
That was our third flight of the day. It was our last flight of the trip, and we were looking forward to going home. Me to San Francisco and Jeff back to Chicago and eventually up here to Madison. So it just cleared up in New York. It had been snowing the night before and that morning. It was clear and cold, light wind out of the north. We were running a little bit behind because of de-icing and weather and air traffic control delays earlier in the day. And we left the gate a little bit after 3 o'clock and took off shortly after.
What, Jeff, whose leg was it to fly?
It was mine. I admit it. I'm the guy that made Sully Sullenberger all he is today.
Thank you.
I'm the guy that flew the airplane into the birds.
Do you recall any conversation that you had when you crawled into the cockpit or spoke to each other about the day or, you know, in PA announcements?
We don't crawl into the cockpit.
We've trained him well.
So how was the beginning of the flight, Jeff?
It was perfectly normal. You know, the weather had cleared up. It was still a cold day. You know, we were all excited because it was our last leg. And when we got back to Charlotte, we were going to get to go home, which obviously didn't happen. But started up, taxied out, just as normal as could be, you know, to the end of the runway. And the takeoff was absolutely normal. You know, Sully taxis the airplane. The captain always taxis. And transfers control to me by saying, "Your aircraft." So when we're clear for takeoff, he says, "Your aircraft." I said, "My aircraft." And we start the takeoff roll, push the power up, 80 knots, V1, rotate, start to climb out, raise the gear. And everything's absolutely normal. We're turning heading in north, which is our normal departure. And about 3,000 feet or so, I don't know, I just caught these glimpse of these birds out of the corner of my eye and look up. And I mean, I was shocked because they were so close and they were all in a line. And
a lot of them?
A lot of birds, all in a line. I always thought they were Canada geese because whatever flies up, what else flies at 3,000 feet, all in a line. And you know, I thought we were going to fly over the top of them. I remember this sense, this immense feeling of relief. Oh, we're going to fly over the top of them. But then they just started impacting the engines and the wings like hail. And both engines instantly quit. At which point, Sully had had enough of me flying that leg. And the way we signify that in our industry is by Sully saying, "My aircraft." and of course I said, "Your aircraft." So that's my entire contribution to the flight. If you'd like, I could leave now.
Sully, did you see the birds when he saw them? Were you aware of them?
Well, see, the difference between when Jeff saw them and when I saw them is when I saw them, I said, "Birds." I think I saw them a split second after he did, and listening to the cockpit voice recording, I saw them and vocalized that about a second before we hit them. So just over a football field away.
I can't really say what my vocalization was at that moment.
So what happened? What did you see, feel, smell?
We both took showers, right?
Yeah, it was an immediate realization that this was a dire emergency, unlike anything I'd ever experienced in my entire flying career. The sounds the engines made, the vibrations I felt, and then within a few seconds, the smell of the burned birds coming in the cabin area. It told me that the engines had been severely damaged. And then within a few seconds after that, they both rolled back. It was a very sudden, complete, bilaterally symmetrical thrust loss.
So what was your communication back to whoever you were talking to on the ground? Who said what, when?
Well, that was much later. That was probably 25 seconds later.
Well, was there fire? I mean, could you look out and see that the engines were...
Well, actually, in this airplane, you can't see the engines from the cockpit, but in talking to the passengers and reading their accounts, passengers sitting behind the wings on both sides said, yes, they saw fire coming out of the engines.
What was the effect on everything you're looking at in the cockpit at the time of the engines being out?
All my instruments remained powered throughout the entire episode, and so all my instrumentation was normal. But just from the sounds and the vibrations and the engine indications, we knew that we had severely damaged engines, and we began to maintain control of the airplane, take remedial steps, and then do the checklist. And then at about that point, then I made my first call to ATC.
And you tried to restart?
Yeah, Jeff did, and he failed utterly. But he didn't have much time.
So that's when you made your first call back?
Yeah, I think at about the 25-second point or so, I made the Mayday call. Although it turns out that Patrick Harden, the departure controller at New York TRACON on Long Island, never heard my Mayday call because he was actually transmitting to us at the same time, giving us a heading change to 270 that I never heard. And of course, he never heard my Mayday call. What he heard was the remainder of my transmission about hitting the birds, thrust loss, and my initial option that I considered was to return to LaGuardia.
So, Jeff, what are you doing now? It's his airplane with no engines. What do you do now?
I'm pretty much panicking at this moment. No, we got a procedure for trying to restart the engines, and it's in this what we call a quick reference handbook, which is just a series of checklists that we have to accomplish. So, I was trying to find the right page, open it up, and of course it's a three-page checklist. You know, we used to have shorter checklists, but then the lawyers got a hold of them. So now it's unaccomplishable, and at least in that kind of, I got about halfway through it. I thought that was pretty good.
Wow.
But obviously it didn't work.
So, Sully, this is 25, 30, 35 seconds later, thereabouts, yes?
Yeah, like you said, the entire time from the time we hit the birds until we were in the water was 208 seconds. And so, we got a lot done in that time. Maintaining control of the airplane, taking the initial remedial steps, communicating our situation, and then deciding what heading to fly to choose an option to land on.
Now, they were suggesting options one, go back to LGA, right?
Well, actually, I was the one who suggested that. And then and Patrick Harden, the departure controller, was very astute. He did a number of things right. First, he didn't overload me by asking the usual question, the fuel and souls on board. He knew that was clearly a low priority, so he didn't even go there. He also offered me options rather than giving me direction, because I think he clearly intuitively understood that it was our choice to make, not his, and that he had to offer us options and support us with information and not overload us. And so at the same time, he was also having to control his other traffic.
So Teterboro was not a possibility. Going back to LaGuardia, not a possibility.
Right.
Churn through as quickly as you did it in your head, your options, the consideration, the things that you had to consider to make the decision that you made. How quickly did that happen, and what were the considerations?
Well, I think it actually happened in less time than it took you to ask that question. But,
yeah.
But it had to happen very quickly. The reason I took control of the airplane wasn't any lack of confidence in Jeff. It was actually that I knew that Jeff was new to the airplane because he had told me, not because of anything else. In fact, had he not told me that first day that he was new to the airplane, I wouldn't have known, because he was very skilled at everything he had done from the very beginning of the trip. But as captain, it was my responsibility in this dire emergency. I had the greater experience in this particular aircraft type. Jeff had been more recently trained in the simulator on all the emergency procedures, including the use of that checklist that has 157 procedures in it, and it's about an inch thick. And he had to find the right one, which is number 27. And so it seemed like it was the best division of duties to do it that way. In addition, all the landmarks I needed to see to make these choices and choose among these three options were to my left, out my left side windows. And so I began to make a left turn. And in the turn, I was going to have to decide what heading to roll out on, depending upon which option I chose.
What was the condition of the water when you looked down at the Hudson?
Cold.
And wet.
The fact that it had cleared up was a big advantage for us, and I could, even before this, I could see the river clearly. It was the only option that I was certain was within our gliding distance. It appeared to be relatively smooth. There was a light wind out of the north. The river surface appeared to be smooth. There was not a lot of traffic on the river, but there were some boats near Midtown, and that's where we ended up, and I was very happy that we did.
I asked you earlier about how the losing the engines affected all the other systems in the airplane. Was there anything that you could do in the cockpit to assure that you maintained all your instrumentation and whatever you needed to ditch?
Yes, in fact, before I took control of the airplane, I took two steps by memory. I turned the engine mode knob to continuous, which turns on the electronic ignition for the engines, provides a spark, so if there's a chance of a relight in the case of a flame out, that is going to happen. And this, about 3 seconds later, I started the auxiliary power unit, an APU, which essentially is a miniature jet engine that we use for backup electrical and air and hydraulic power.
Is this a fly-by-wire airplane?
Yes, it is.
What effect does that have, or did that have, if any, on the whole process of your descent?
It It probably didn't have much of an effect. I don't think that we would have had a very different outcome had this been a different type. A 737, for example, which is a very similar physical configuration with the underslung engines under the wings. The fly-by-wire system does a couple of things. It does afford flight envelope protections. In normal law, which is the normal configuration where the flight control computers are interpreting the pilot's inputs and then sending electrical signals to the actuators to be activated, it limits how high you can raise the nose, how low you can push the nose, how much bank you can use, how slow and how fast you can go. But we never actually approached those limits, and so those protections, the absolute maximum protections, never actually came into play. The one thing that it's a bit different than a conventional airplane in is that it has auto trimming. So you don't have to manually use the pitch trim. It trims for you. The downside of that, and it's a minor point, is that when your speed changes, it's not always readily apparent to you just from a natural feel of the controls. They don't get heavier. They always feel the same. So you have to watch your speed indication a bit more closely.
What were the exchanges, if any, between the two of you from the time you made the left turn and you knew you were going down? What exchanges were there between the two of you?
Well, we had, on the checklist I was doing, we had some items that were required both of us to confirm or acknowledge. But there wasn't a lot of talk going on. You know, our procedures kind of teach us that, you know, we know what the other pilot is doing. That's kind of the advantage of being highly trained, is I know what he was doing. I knew what I could depend on him to do, and vice versa. He knew what he could depend on me to do, and he didn't have to watch. It's not really like it's not a top-down management style anymore in airline cockpits. Both pilots have a role, and both pilots know what that role is.
Right. What is a ditch switch?
On this airplane, there's a ditching push button on the overhead panel. On every pressurized airplane, there are certain openings in the fuselage. And they're used for different purposes. The ditching push button is designed to automatically close all those to make the airplane a little bit more watertight. In this particular case, it wouldn't have mattered because as soon as we touched the water, the contact with the river opened much larger holes than any of those holes that the ditching push button was designed to close. And in fact, because that was one of the later steps on this 3-page checklist that we only got through not even quite halfway, we didn't get there.
What, to your knowledge, was going on back in the passenger compartment with the three flight attendants and the passengers?
The flight attendants in front, I believe, had a conversation about what had happened and some discussion about it being a bird strike, and they said the cabin was very quiet. Like I said, some of the passengers observed flames coming from the engines if they were sitting behind the wings, but I think people were fairly quiet. There was some talking. Some people were turning on their phones and texting, trying to call others, but there wasn't a lot of discussion that I was aware of.
Yeah. Jeff, so there was no exchange, there was no exchanges at all between the two of you about what's about to happen?
I don't think so. I mean, we both knew what was going on. You know, I was pausing with what I was doing to listen to what Sully and Patrick Harden, the air traffic controller, were discussing, because I remember particularly when Patrick Harden pointed out Teterboro, and I looked out there and I thought, that doesn't look good to me. And Sully didn't say anything right away. And I began to get concerned that he was going to go for it. And then he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's all over the paper. It's something like, you know, we can't make it, we're going to be in the Hudson. Because I remember I was holding my checklist and I went, good. You know, and then went back to what I was doing, because I was concerned about that.
So you're on the way down. Tell us about it.
My focus had to narrow the lower we got. And we were very busy. We were still trying to finish the checklist as much as we can, give every chance for those engines to produce usable thrust again before we're in the water. But the lower I got, the more my focus had to be outside. We configured the airplane, and ultimately I was just looking at the airspeed and the water and then trying to judge the flare height. And then before landing, about 45 seconds or a minute before we landed, I'd made a, this is the captain, brace for impact announcement in the cabin.
Describe the impact, Jeff.
You know, up front it didn't seem that bad. I mean, obviously it was because there was a lot of damage back of the wing. But up front I thought it felt like we skipped and then just kind of, gently kind of slid into the river. I mean, water went over the windshield and, you know, obviously we decelerated fairly rapidly, but I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, you know, the nose popped up. We both looked at each other and said, that wasn't so bad. Isn't that how you remember it?
Yeah. I think our sense was that the airplane, as soon as we stopped, our sense was that the airplane was still intact, that the touchdown hadn't been too bad, that it was clearly survivable, that we'd solved the first major problem of the day, and that we still had more problems yet to solve, but that the big problem had been solved.
So what happened then? You're in the water, you come to a stop.
Well, then Jeff began doing the first officer duties on the cover of our quick reference handbook, which is the evacuation checklist. And I got up and opened the cabin door and said one word, evacuate, to the two flight attendants in the front.
The flight attendants, what did they do? Who does what? Who did what?
Well, the two flight attendants in front were the two I could observe, and they immediately opened the 1L, the left front, and the 1R, the right front doors, and began the evacuation through those slides.
They didn't even know we were on the water until
really?
They opened the door and saw water. We didn't have the opportunity to warn them at all, so that was as much of a surprise to them as anybody.
And that included the flight attendants?
Yeah, the two flight attendants in front. They did not know we were on the water until they opened the door.
Which is a real testament to their training. Because one of the things that they're trained to do is do certain commands based upon a landing on land and do different things for a water landing. And as soon as they saw that they were in water and assessed their situation, they immediately switched to their training and began calling out their commands for the water evacuation.
So there wasn't time, obviously, for life vests and so on, is that right?
You know, I had to choose my words carefully when it came time to the announcement, and I wanted people to brace and not be fumbling for life vests when it came time to land. It was so extremely time compressed, there wasn't time to give them a full picture, although I would like to have, obviously.
So describe what you saw and what you did once the doors were open, the slides are out. What did you see? What did people do, including the flight attendants? What did the passengers do? And what did you do?
Well, they began moving quickly and expeditiously toward all the exits. And since the airplane was sitting at a nose-high, tail-low attitude in the water, it rendered unusable the aft, left, and right exits. So we had the overwing exits, and we had the forward door exits that we had to use for the entire complement of 155 passengers and crew. And we got everybody out in about 3 minutes.
3 minutes?
3 minutes.
There was a lot of enthusiasm amongst the passengers for getting out.
Sully, I understand that you were the last off the aircraft?
Yeah, the last three were the A flight attendant, Donna Dent, and then Jeff, and then me.
How long did it take for people to... He just said man of the year is what he just said. You know,
I think Jeff would appreciate that.
No. I was just going to say, I don't know whether you said man or men, but I would, if you said man, I would say men of the year, not man of the year.
And you may have heard me speak before. You probably know what my response to that would be. Crew of the year.
Right. What was the process, boats coming up, getting all of you, 150 passengers and the five of you off the wings, out of boats, and up
the first, because of where we landed and when we landed, the first New York Waterway ferry arrived at the airplane less than 4 minutes after we landed, which was wonderful. And they began arriving very rapidly after that.
So how long did it take before everybody was out of the water, or do you know?
I'd have to watch again that security tape that Con Edison had, but I want to say it was not a very long time,
yeah.
A number of minutes, less than 10 minutes.
Wow. Jeff, what, and to both of you, what was it like once you did all get onto boats? What happened then? I mean, what did the authorities do? What do they do with all of you?
That was what they were wondering, too. This apparently doesn't happen every day. Because they had no idea what to do. Is it true that you told them, arrest us or let us go?
No.
It was very disorganized, but there were more police officers, I think, at our ferry dock than passengers.
I've got to say that as I got off the ferry at Pier 79 and stepped onto the dock, the very first person I saw when I came ashore was Captain Dan Britt, our U.S. Airways LaGuardia Union representative, and he has my eternal gratitude also, as well as Jeff, for having heard the news, left his Manhattan apartment with his airline uniform, his ID on, found where we were, crossed the police lines, and was there to assist me in making the company notifications, making sure that our injured flight attendant, Doreen Welsh, was being attended to, and she was, gathering the crew together, making sure the passengers were being treated, and then began the attempt that took actually many hours to fully account for all 155 and to make sure that everyone was safe, because I was certain I'd gotten everyone off the airplane. What I did not yet know, of course, was that everyone was accounted for and saved.
So what about hospital care? Was there an attempt in any way to get any, all of you, to hospitals or to some kind of medical care, just as
After we'd spent some time in the ferry terminal, we did go to a hospital and were checked out, and we were there for a number of hours also.
You know, that's the state of medical care in this country right now. You know how this works. They won't admit you until they take your blood pressure, you know, your vitals, all that stuff. So you do all that. And then they put you in a room, and the doctor comes in and says, is there anything wrong with you? And we said, no. So then they say, okay, well, we have to release you. But they won't release you until they take your blood pressure and temperature and take all your vitals again. And you sign proper statements saying that I'm released, you know, releasing them from all indemnity, you know, just like I had to do when I rode that Ford Trimotor today for the EAA.
You know, I think all of us had the impression, or at least I did, that all of you were soaking wet from being in the water. How accurate was that?
Well, I mean, we were wet up to our knees, I think, from wading in the back. I mean, at least I was. And because, you know, the water was, you know, we were back, you know, Sully was going back to make sure all the passengers were out, and I was getting life vests and throwing them out the wing exits, so... So, you know, back around the wings, it was about knee deep. And, you know, it was sinking further as we were in it, at least that's my recollection, but it seemed perfectly stable, like it wasn't going to sink out from underneath us at any time, so I wasn't particularly concerned about anything like that. But it did get those shoes nice and wet. And I got a lot of money for those last night for the Young Eagles at the auction up there at the Eagle Hang. $76,000 for shoes. That may be more than Imelda Marcos.
Sully, how did you, how and when did you call your home to alert Lori?
It was probably when I got on the ferry. I only got up to not quite my waist, and my cell phone was on my belt, and so it remained dry. And so I was able to call home as soon as I got on the ferry, and my wife had not heard about this. She didn't have the news on, and I had to be the one to tell her. And she didn't know what to do, so she decided to go ahead and get the girls from school and just bring them home.
Wow. Jeff, how did you contact home?
By the time we clambered up this boarding net into the airplane, or into the boat, and I walked in, I was looking for someplace that was warm because, I was absolutely frozen in my hands. I couldn't even, from being in that water, I couldn't even, grasp anything. And this passenger, he's got this flip phone, and he was just flipping it shut. And he looks at me and offers it to me, just like that. So, I open it up and I dial it with my knuckle. And my wife answers. She says, "Hello." And I said, "It's Jeff." And of course, she says, "Oh." ...25 years of marriage. I said, and I'm, staring out the window, this airplane's floating by with the passengers on board. Still on the wings, as I recall. I said, "I don't think I'm gonna be home tonight." And she says, "Why?" And I don't know, you're in shock, you've been through this horrible experience, you're not thinking right. For some reason, I wanted to get off the phone as rapidly as possible. So I said, We took off from LaGuardia, we hit birds, we just had to ditch the airplane in the Hudson, we think we got everybody out okay. I gotta go. And I hung up.
That's great. There is one other person here tonight who was on the airplane. And her name is Stephanie King. And she and her fiancé, who's until recently a U.S. Army captain, served two tours in Afghanistan, his name's Andrew Gray. They're going to get married on the 22nd of August. And Stephanie, would you stand up, please, wherever you are? Where's Stephanie King? I can't
Apparently
see
they didn't
you.
Give Stephanie good seats.
There she is. Oh, she's in the back there.
I got to tell you, I told this story to her that, because she's from West Bend, and it was in the local papers that she was on board the airplane, so I thought, I'm going to get in contact with her. So I went on the internet, read the articles, where she lives, and Stephanie King, blah, 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 and that she's a lawyer. And I thought, maybe I'll just let this lie.
Sully, are you back to flying yet? Are you flying?
Not yet, September.
September? Jeff, are you flying?
Yeah, I've got an airline marriage. And my wife got tired of me being around the house within 2 months. And I was still gone. We were doing a lot of media things. I was gone at least 3 days a week. But I tell people that the sanctity of my marriage is heavily dependent on me being gone at least 6 days a week.
I have just the opposite problem. I've been gone 6 days a week, and that's not working very well.
Sully, as you look back on this experience, just in terms of what you were together and your crew were able to do that day. Wait, let me back up just a second before we go there. Talk about this airplane. How significant was the design and construction of this airplane in allowing you to pull off what you pulled off?
Well, all airplanes are designed to the same certification standards. They have to follow the same regulations, the same requirements, the same, you know, amounts of excess capacity above the strain that it might be expected to encounter. I don't think it mattered a whole lot what kind of airplane it was. What mattered the most was the configuration of the airplane and the fact that we were able to land in a tail low attitude without having one of the engines touch first and begin to move us off a straight path. I think that was more important than the type of airplane or the manufacturer it was.
Back to the question I started to ask, as you look back over this experience, I mean, it happened to be you two guys in that airplane that day. What do you think your life experience had to do with the fact that you could pull it off, both of you? Your aviation experience, how significant was that?
Well, you know, I think it's just that, you know, we've been around a long time and seen a lot of things. And, you know, it really didn't faze us much. It was just another problem to solve. You know, I mean, it wasn't like we were scared or anything. I mean, we just did our jobs. And, you know, people want to make us heroes, and I'm very resistant to that. We're not heroes, but I'm very proud of the fact that we did our jobs.
You weren't scared?
You know, when I was scared was the next day, you know, when our union president was in the lobby and he comes up to me and he says, "Jeff, you wouldn't believe what the press is making of this." Because, you know, I hadn't been watching the TV or news. You don't want to see anything. And, you know, the last time U.S. Air crashed an airplane in LaGuardia, they were trying to arrest the pilots. The district attorney was trying to track them down and arrest the pilots. So, of course, I looked at him and I said, "What do you mean?" And he says, no, they're making you guys out like heroes." I thought, heroes? I mean, we just crashed an airplane. You know, we don't know what... I mean, you got to admit here, this is something that is unique in aviation. That you can crash an airplane and 5 days later you're at the inauguration of a president. That you're going to the Super Bowl, that you're going on all these media outlets and talking about how great you are. You know, you're throwing out first pitches. This isn't something that usually happens to pilots who crash airplanes.
Is this a great country or what?
I'm just thinking about the fact that it's obvious if you've watched and listened to them being interviewed on television and so on, at how calm and together and thoughtful they have both been in responding to a zillion questions from everywhere in the media. And I'm wondering if you can describe what this experience has been like to go from near anonymity from the public's point of view, to all of a sudden being besieged by the media. What is that? Describe what that's been like.
I'm sorry to correct you, but the premise of your question actually is false.
In what way?
I had complete anonymity.
Oh.
Seriously, the one word that my family and I used since the first day to describe this entire experience has been surreal. At first, it was simply hard to believe that it happened. I mean, it was just such an intense experience. And at first, we were sort of in a haze about exactly, you know, all of it. But, you know, I think within a few days, we began to have an inkling about, like Jeff said, the fact that we weren't watching TV made it harder. We just heard reports about what people were saying and thinking about this event. And something about this event touched a nerve. Something about when it happened, how it happened, where it happened, the time in our nation's, our world's history that it happened, a time when people were looking for good news. They wanted a reason to feel hopeful again. They wanted to be reassured that all the things that we believe, that we hold dear, really are true, even if they aren't apparent every day. Something about this was made people feel a certain way, not only about the event, but about us. And I think it was a gradual realization of this, but it was overwhelming. Much of the attention and the support was very welcome, but it was just so intense and so sudden. It was a steep learning curve. It was drinking from a fire hose. And it's got my way of describing it, it's still crazy, but just through practice, we're getting better at crazy.
You know, one thing, it doesn't matter how many times you tell your wife not to talk to the press. Doesn't work. You know, I'm reading, I didn't really read hardly anything about it, but I happen to be, you know, looking at this headline on the internet, and it says that, that there a quote from my wife saying, you know, they're asking her, you know, what has the Pilots Association done for your husband? And she says, well, they got him new underwear. You know, this is about 3 weeks later. And I said, Barb? What is this? And she says, well, you know, you told them, you know, that you told me that they got you, you know, clothes and stuff. I said, you told the press that they got me new underwear? You didn't have that happen? By the way, they were mediums. Those babies fit me like a thong.
They bought you underwear? I just wanted some dry socks.
This conversation has taken on a whole kind of nighttime cable approach, which is a little uncomfortable for some of us, you know?
Painting a picture, are we?
Can anything good in terms of civil aviation come out of this accident and the fact that you did what you did and everybody survived this in terms of the future of civil aviation, anything good come out of this?
Well, we've heard from a lot of our colleagues and pilots, not only at U.S. Airways, but at all of the airlines, and they tell us a couple of things. And it's a very consistent message across the board. They thank us and our crew for what we've done, and they tell us that for the first time in years, sometimes decades, they feel pride in going to work. But I think that right before Buffalo, this nation had gone through two calendar years without a single passenger fatality at a major jet carrier in the United States, which is a phenomenal achievement. Millions of passengers, millions of flights. And the way we do that is that everybody who touches the airplane has a duty to make it right. And we certainly feel that obligation. And we also, since the event, have felt an intense obligation. Since we are, as I've been saying, we've been chosen by circumstance to be at least the temporary spokespeople for the industry, not to mess it up, to be the kind of people that our peers expect us to be and not let them down, and to tell the truth about what's changed in our profession and what we need to do going forward to keep it as safe as it is, to continue to renew these investments and not just rely on the previous generation's investments.
You know, it's... It's hard for me, anyway, to imagine there could have been any two better representatives of aviation than these two gentlemen as a result of this. Tom Poperesny, are you back there? Tom? Yes, he is. We got a surprise. Tom?
Wait. Mike, I just got off a trip.
Are you wearing a mic? You wearing a mic?
I feel I just got off a trip with my flight bag here. I found this floating in the water, and I thought I'd bring it out here. It's not wet anymore. Jeff talked about his shoes. What brand did you say they were?
Skechers.
Oh, Skechers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jeff mentioned last night at the Gathering of Eagles auction that he sold his shoes. And just to give some background, earlier in the week, Jeff was at a reception talking to one of our directors, and we were talking about the Gathering of Eagles and the importance of the program, and he said, well, I've got the pair of shoes that I was wearing on the flight, and they're back home in the closet, and I was thinking about selling them on eBay, but I'm not sure I'm going to do it. So he said, would you like to have that for the auction? The seller will sign one shoe, and I'll sign the other. That sounded like a pretty good deal. And then he said, well, I'll throw in my flight jacket also. And his flight jacket and shoes with signatures from Sully and Jeff raised $76,000 for Young Eagles. That's... But every pilot knows what this is. And this was Jeff's flight bag that was on the flight. And it's going to the EA Museum. And on the front it says, US Airways 1549, January 15, 2009, Sully Jeffrey Skiles. This is going in the museum. You know, David, I could tell watching you, this is one of your more unique interviews.
Well, it should be.
But, you know, it's interesting sometimes how people can make humor out of a difficult situation. And there's no question this was a, as you said, dire emergency, difficult situation. And to see the interplay between these two gentlemen represents the leadership and the teamwork where they can, quote, to a certain extent, make light of a difficult situation, but perform beautifully. And Sully and Jeff, on behalf of this audience, what I want to say, and what I've heard all week long, is the fact is that as proud as we are of what you accomplished on January 15th, we're more proud of what you've accomplished since then on behalf of aviation. You've represented us in a manner that we can't tell you how much we appreciate. You've been of the highest standards, and most importantly, you've done more for aviation since then than can ever be imagined. I know you're going to do more. And all of us want to stand up and say thank you very much. Stephanie, come on. Stephanie King, why don't you come on up here? She's in the back there with her fiancé.
Stephanie?
She was a passenger on US Air 1549.
Yeah,
Stephanie King, why don't you come up and join us?
Hey, while she's walking up, I want to ask Jeff one more question. How many more times would you like to be called a co-pilot?
Well, I've been called the co-pilot a lot. And, you know, my latest story, I got a dozen of these. But my latest one just happened yesterday. In fact, these guys are probably out in the crowd here. We had to go back to the hotel, and it started to rain. So Sully and my wife went back with Lynn, who's been assigned to us, our Gestapo, from the EAA, in his big white SUV. But I decided I want to get my golf cart back there. So I'm going down and bumping along down that North 40 road there, you know, by the airplanes, and it started to rain. I'm wiping the rain out of my eyes. The wind's blowing, and I stop to give these two guys a ride, and they get on, so they step on board the golf cart. You know, you can all sit down. Anyways, I stopped to give these two guys a ride, and so we're bumping along, you know, it's raining on us, and all of a sudden one of them says, hey! That's Sully Sullenberger. because they'd just driven by, you know, on the perimeter road. And the other guy says, no way. And he says, yeah, I saw him in the window there. That's Sully Sullenberger. So I said, shake my hand. And he says, why? I said, because I'm Jeff Skiles. And he says, who? So I said, the co-pilot. So he's going, oh, wow, geez, you're the co-pilot. Oh, wow, you know, great job. Wow, great job you guys did, unbelievable job. And this guy goes, say, big old difference in the kind of transportation between you two, isn't there? You know, Sully gets the chauffeur-driven white SUV. I get the golf cart.
Stephanie,
yes.
What happened in the airplane for you that day and you and your fiancé?
Andrew and I were, I mean, we just looked at each other and told each other we loved each other and started praying. And then we made it to these to them.
How? Yeah. Where did you go? Were you out in the wing? You
could we were on the right wing, yes.
The wing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you were out on the boat?
Yeah.
And out of there?
Yes.
Listen, congratulations.
Thank you.
To you both.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Because I know they're going to try to come.
Right?
To the wedding.
Yes.
Wedding.
But
I need to finish that story about the golf course. I want you to know that we offered Jeff a chance to ride in that car repeatedly, and he said, no, I'm fine with the golf cart. It's not going to rain.
Thank you, Sully.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stephanie, Sully Sullenberger, Jeff Stiles, thank you. Wait one second. Wow. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't see them, but Jeff's mother and dad are right down here in the front row. Great. Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening.